Yeah, the webby thing at the service, she kept catching my eye because people there either know who I am or for some reason they think they should, mm-hmm. you know, they just respond. Mm-hmm. And, you know, A, when people are running, I don't want to have anything to do with them. I want your public record to be what I'm dealing with.
Right, right, right.
But I heard independently from two people just bizarre stories about her from way before. And it's just like, you know, these are good, strong, loaded Republicans mm-hmm. who are basically saying, I'm not supporting her.
Right.
And it's like, you know, you can't have that. Yeah. Or you have to know it's there and you've got to deal with it.
Right.
You've got to know the doors to knock on and go yeah. and say hi.
First person you do opposition research on is on yourself.
Yeah.
And exactly. you do it tougher and nastier than the opponent is going to do.
Yeah.
You know exactly what kind of, you write all of the attack ads that your opponent doesn't even know about.
Yeah, exactly. And it's clear that she hasn't done that, or maybe it's been done and she hasn't paid attention, but whatever it is.
Sometime we're going to talk about the Duane Samples case and mm-hmm. as really mm-hmm. one of the governor's mistakes, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a week of half days being tougher than Mike Wallace mm-hmm. with him, to mm-hmm. the point that he got angry with me.
Yeah.
He's not going to say that. He's not going to bring that up. He said, if you get angry like that during this interview,
yeah. you're toast.
Yeah, and we prepared for that better and more extensively than any campaign debate, and I did all the debate prep with
yeah.
him. So from 78 on.
Yeah.
So anyway, okay.
Okay.
We can get sidetracked real easily.
Exactly. So let's start out with the fun thing, the Mubarak knife story.
Yes.
So what I've heard secondhand is Sammy Kahn in his cups telling an attorney who just sent me an email that there was a Gerber knife in a nice Myrtlewood case as a gift for Mubarak, and it got there, and it encountered quite a time with the guards coming in the door. So,
well, all right, if you can put that on hold, I'll get you a duplicate. I'll show you a duplicate.
Cool.
I think I've got it close by. And believe me, in this house, we just moved.
Uh-huh.
Here 6 months ago, and we're still trying to find things. I can't find my blue binder from the planning of the ceremony.
Oh, great.
Oh, I don't think this is the one. Let me check. No, not the right one. Another Gerber knife. I have someplace a duplicate of it, but yeah, it's a... But yeah, what's your question?
So, well, the question is, did that happen?
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, we regularly took to Arab leaders and or people in the Near East, quote, Middle East, cutlery,
mm-hmm.
sharp things, mm-hmm. steel. There, it's mm-hmm. a culture of that. That was one of our advice things that came through. And the Gerber people, being an Oregon product, of course, was great.
Yeah.
Hindsight, looking way, way back when Gerber was just getting started in Southeast Portland, they were a customer. I got to put that one on. Yeah, that could just happen all the time if I'm not careful. I wonder if I can turn it off. Hello? If you don't mind, I'll let it ring, look at caller ID, and then just...
Yep, no problem.
Okay. We regularly took those kinds of things, often engraved, mm-hmm. and the one place where it was like, was with Mubarak.
Uh-huh.
And to the point that well before we even knew where we were meeting him, because it was not traditional, it was the way they operated, whether it be Mubarak or whether it be Assad or whatever, you didn't know where you were going to meet
right.
them, which of their many places that they would stay. And so we gave it to somebody who then literally one person brought it in without us even being close to it, opened mm-hmm. it up, and Mubarak went, oh, very nice, thank you so much, closed it up and took it away.
Mm-hmm.
I would think they would have a kind of a no weapons zone around people mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. especially since the assassination.
He got into office with his own bodyguards killing him.
Yeah,
killing Sadat.
Right. So the point being that they had protocols that, and I don't know what it would be like in the White House today. I mean, whether they would let a governor of the same party in or not. I mean, I don't mind that kind of security, but it was noticeably different than it was anywhere else. And we didn't even try to get a knife into Assad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were just lucky to meet with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was, you guys weren't taking the knife in.
Oh God, no.
Okay. Okay.
No, we brought the knife. We announced we wanted to make it as a gift to the president. And it was an Oregon product, and of course it's just beautiful. It's about this long, and, mm-hmm. and you know, has the guards here and a beautiful handle and this stiletto type thing. It's very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea whether Mubarak ever had it around him or not. And one thinks again from just reading history that he probably did not have weapons just sitting around.
No,
unless they were in his pocket.
Yeah,
he probably did not because of again the culture and the history of that whole.
Yeah,
area.
Exactly. Yeah, one imagines a
weapon-free zone.
Well, and an Alibaba cave with gifts.
Yeah,
somewhere.
Yeah, which is the way it is with the President of the United States now.
You bet. Yeah. Okay, good. Right. That's out of the way. So only one of these questions comes from the non-election stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But this is in your just remembering the governor, as he was dying and right afterwards. Atiyah and his state police driver would pull over and arrest drunk drivers.
They would pull them over.
Uh huh.
And arrest them.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah. Well, they would pull over speeders too.
Yeah.
And absolutely. And Lon can confirm that until John Williams said, "You stop that.
Yeah.
You call it in.
Yeah.
We'll take care of that."
Yeah.
And he said, well, but the governor said, I don't care what the governor said.
Mm-hmm.
You are not to be enforcing things.
Right.
Now, the other thing that would happen when they were late, 95 to 95, in service, headed to Portland, running late, 10-4.
Mm-hmm.
And so most everybody knew the car, but they took the one off a long time mm-hmm. early on because mm-hmm. people would notice it and that was a problem.
Yeah.
And again, it's not like it is today with three or four vehicles and six to eight people and all that, which is, I'm glad they do that. In fact, I've told Governor Kitzhaber, if anybody ever challenges that, have him call me first because I'll be glad to support any expenditures necessary. I'd also like to get him an airplane so he can get out around the state, but that's another issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, they would go fast sometimes down the freeway. They would make some really good time.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. One of the things I'm thinking of doing next summer is my wife and I recreating one of Vic's road trips,
mm-hmm.
or two or three of them or something, and going, you know, and see if we can find people in Enterprise who say, yeah, I remember when the governor was here, or, you know, that kind of thing. But it'll take a lot longer. Okay, so let's get into the campaign stuff.
Sure.
You have some really good stuff on infighting, the blame game at the beginning of the 82 campaign and things like that. I'd like you to talk about how the socializing of a campaign works. You've got the governor picking people like you, but there are the people who want to get the governor elected. There are the mysterious Blake Herrings on the side who feel that they should at least have a say, if not pull strings, and those kinds of things. So you had been with the 78 campaign, but 82, you're now the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about the socializing those different parts of the campaign with you as the campaign manager. How did you approach people? Did you just kind of say, I'm the governor's person and this is the way we do things? I mean, how did that all work?
I knew them all. There was no introductions necessary. They were all, and by the time we got to 82, Punch was off in Romania someplace, and he was kind of the glue that held together the general in 78.
Okay.
Once Tom McCall was out of it, he stayed out of it until McCall was out of it, and mm-hmm. then he was going to support whoever was the primary winner. But then he was appointed by the president as an ambassador. So Blake was by far the strongest force
mm-hmm.
in that. And in the conversation that this committee, which there was never an official committee, but there were the people who ran things.
Right.
And he was the driving force on that mm-hmm. committee, and everybody knew it, and that was just his personality as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was really a very strong guy, and he raised a whole lot of money, which helps give you credentials to join that kind of a committee,
right.
is when you bring in the dollars. So there really was never any, I mean, the internal politics occurred more in the governor's office, which I guess is natural, than they did in terms of that committee.
Okay.
That committee, really, as long as things were going okay,
mm-hmm.
they were focused on fundraising. And once we had a plan in place, what we were going to do, and once we had the way it was going to be implemented, and as long as there was enough money there mm-hmm. to be spent,
mm-hmm.
We were okay.
Mm-hmm.
There was a point where I warned the boss that when Paul Newman got more engaged in the campaign later on, that, you know, he wanted us to spend everything we had down to the point of going potentially short on a payroll. And I wasn't going to do that, but I was going to commit early because we had the advantage of committing a huge amount of money and holding the really prime avails.
Right.
And we did that.
Yeah.
But we still had plenty of stuff. But his, Paul Newman's point, and it's a good political point for internal, you talk about internal discussions. If the finance committee sees, in those days, $200,000 in the bank, they're less motivated to raise money than if they see $25,000 in the mm-hmm. bank. Mm-hmm. And I didn't look at it that way as much as I looked at it from a media buying perspective. And we had a great media buyer at PSW.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up putting putting the candidate, Kulongoski, in a position of, you know, buying Channel 12 at 3 in the morning right after, wake up,
yeah.
free is a very good price, kind of, and nobody was watching.
Yeah.
And so we just sopped up all the avails, which is great when you've got the money to be able to do it. But, yeah, there was nobody really questioned anything, I don't think, except for social events that I ran into people like Hyder or Faust or Johnson mm-hmm. or Blake in the 82 at mm-hmm. all. I mean, we even had a situation where Roy Livermore, who was the treasurer, who I had a lot of contact with,
mm-hmm.
was on the purse board, safe board, when we stole $81 right. million dollars from safe. And he was just steaming about it. And he and I just agreed we wouldn't talk about it.
Exactly.
Because of that. But yeah. No, there was not, there was none of that going on. And it was very important. I didn't want the job.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a loser.
Mm-hmm.
I turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
And then the governor said, do it for me. And I said, I can't say no to that. And he smiled and said, I know. And we went from there. I did not want the job. And the only deal I had in taking the campaign manager's job was that there would be no of that kind of internal
mm-hmm.
cutthroat kind mm-hmm. of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to do that was to say there will be no meetings unless I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
The meeting will not have occurred unless right. I'm involved in the meeting, because I'd seen that kind of thing happen before. And so we didn't have any mm-hmm. of those kind of meetings. There just wasn't that. You didn't hear about something that somebody was concerned about. You heard about it from them,
mm-hmm.
and it was all very open and above board. Plus the key, and if we've talked about this before, I apologize, but the key was that the agreement between Jerry and the governor and myself pretty much was, and it's difficult for the governor because it's pretty much the focus for running state government, unlike virtually all other times in his tenure, was going to be Jerry. She would keep him informed. He would be making mm-hmm. the decisions. But day-to-day, operationally, she was the COO, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And the campaign, same thing. Stay out of my hair. You'll hear, or I will read to you the script from every single ad that goes out before it goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And you will have veto power over every single ad. And he never vetoed a one.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I got a plan, and I got a budget, and you're not going to go into debt, and you're going to win, and leave me alone.
Yeah,
and that, of course, is how every state agency was being run anyway.
Yeah.
So it was very comfortable for him. And so we would have 2-minute conference calls, and that was it, and mm-hmm. and settle things so quickly because we all just kind of knew each other that well that it wasn't a problem.
Okay, great. Let's get to the drinker. Were there other reasons why Bill Dawkins was a bad choice for the 82 campaign?
Well, I don't have the name of who he was,
mm-hmm.
but I do know that there was a general impression by everyone who was at the party mm-hmm. that night that he was not a good choice.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been recommended by the people at Pye Schmidt Westerdahl, and we knew that Sharon was leaving.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there are some indications that she may have even had a diagnosis by then, but I can't say that for sure.
Yeah.
But we knew she was leaving because we knew we were in trouble, obviously. Yeah. And the individual that had been recommended was at the victory party, which was a somber affair because we didn't win that big. And it mm-hmm. was us against people like, I think, Bill Patrick and, you know, that kind of stuff. But everyone, to a person, knew that that was not going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the meeting that followed that, we started looking for alternatives, and that's when they came up with me.
Okay. So why was that 82 primary win the single, what you rewrote, the single most depressing evening of the entire 1982 campaign? Was it, I mean, you were really focusing on the 18% that didn't vote for the governor.
Well, first of all, those numbers are not that unusual, but mm-hmm. You had to put that number together with the fact that we spent $300,000 mm-hmm. because we knew we were going to have a tough general election, and that mm-hmm. you can spend $300,000 while the other guys are fighting it out.
Mm-hmm.
And that we knew, and you probably know this because I don't, but you know, obviously by 82, there were more Democrats in Oregon than there were Republicans mm-hmm. and a whole lot of non-affiliateds.
Right.
And that chart continues to grow in that direction. My recollection is there's only like one county that had a majority. It was like Malheur County had a plurality of Republican voters,
which is 300 to 220,
something so, like that. Yeah, yeah. The percentage is there, but the numbers are not,
exactly.
kind of thing. So that was the biggest win for Bob Packwood when he ran against Wayne Morris too, because I was over there as a newsperson. But no, it was depressing because A, we didn't have a manager, and everybody knew that in about 15 minutes.
Okay.
B, we didn't dominate against a no-name list. There was everybody who was on that other on the ballot, basically. Every time they got a vote, that was a Republican who votes in a primary
right.
who was ready to go with somebody else,
right.
anybody but Atiyah. And it was stark,
mm-hmm.
very stark. And Blake picked it up. Blake was like this cheerleader kind of guy. I mean, he basically said, that's fine, we're going to have to do this. This just makes it tougher. And, you know, mm-hmm. he was rah-rah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, so it's good combination of the things.
Mm-hmm.
You talk a lot about enemies in the process of you being chosen as campaign manager, leaving Atiyah's staff as a communications guy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to bring up names, but do you feel that it was... there's another question a little bit later on, and so we can just combine these. You talk about the role of the press secretary as the person who was blamed in the Straub administration, the person who was blamed in the McCall administration. You then took on that role.
Actually, McCall got credit.
Yeah, credit, but it sits there. Whereas today,
we don't even know who they are.
We have no idea who they were. So, talk to me about that culture. Was it just the office? Press secretary is where people just aimed all that kind of thing. Was it people thinking of governors as being kind of here, and the press secretary clearly wasn't delivering the news from the mountain out to the people? I mean, what was that culture like?
Well, boy, I tell you, it was nauseating for me.
Mm-hmm.
I disliked it intensely.
Mm-hmm.
Much later on in my career, I spent, I don't know, 6-7 months helping a United States senator from Nebraska get his office started up.
Mm-hmm.
And it is endemic there. Everybody trying to basically bring other people down around them so that they will be somehow or other more prominent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not I will excel, I'll bring people down. And that includes, leaking, that includes whispering, that includes, playing political games. I mean, political offices attract political people.
Right.
And there are different kinds of political people. There are some mean people who are mm-hmm. political, and there are some naive people who mm-hmm. are in political offices, and there are people who are more loyal to themselves than they are their boss.
Mm-hmm.
The boss is simply a method for them to, in fact, get ahead in their careers. And that wasn't me.
Mm-hmm.
It clearly wasn't me. I mean, I was one of three that was there from day one to the last day, even though I passed up some other opportunities in the process. But yeah, there were some people in our office that did that, and there were others that didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of put together with them kind of thing. But yeah, if you're looking for a place to place blame on when somebody's numbers are down and the press is bad and people are starting to talk and so on and so forth, that's a natural place. Mm-hmm. You know, it must be the press guy. And that's what happened to Ken Phobes in the Straub administration. And it's happened before, it's happened since. I mean, there was not related to me that I know of, but, you know, Christine Miles lasted, what, a week and a half or something in that job and was gone. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that happened. That happened a lot. And there were people who were looking forward to this relatively strong personality, speaking of myself. Some would say verbal bully, but someone whose only loyalty was to the boss and not really to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that, you know, that's not very modest, but it is absolutely true and backed up by the facts that was a threat to them and to start a rumor that I was on my way out or should be out. Now, by the same token, the influentials, as I call them in a lot of the stuff that I've written over time, those are people who also didn't like, frankly, either Jerry or I, because they didn't have as much sway. We were actually doing what the boss wanted us to do and not what they wanted us to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably already heard stories from him and from others about the business community, for example, is just one part of the influentials. You know, basically going into that hallowed hall of a board of control conference room and chewing out the state's chief executive for not doing it their way.
Mm-hmm.
And so those people, you know, they're looking for a way of bringing down anyone who is apparently, in their mind, blocking what, in fact, they want done.
Right.
Because they would suggest that he do X. And again, you've heard the pink elephant story, I know. And then he wouldn't do it. Well, it must have been us that talked him out of it. In many cases, it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would again be more influential if people like me and others were out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I just didn't do a very good. I just did a terrible job of promoting myself.
Mm-hmm.
I really did a terrible job. I mean, I just fell on swords. We joked about the fact that people would say, "Danny Miles." Nowadays, where have I heard that name? Where have I heard that name? I go, well, you've read it in the paper because I was press secretary to Governor Attia for 8 years. And usually it was associated with bad news, because if it was bad news to be delivered to either CEOs or legislators or statewide elected officials, Jerry Thompson did it, and quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was to the general public, it was Danny Miles who did it, and he was in the paper. And if it was good news, it was delivered by the boss.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you get hired on for.
Exactly.
And so that makes it very natural for people to think, gosh, bad news, down in the polls.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I've got a cartoon stuck in there someplace in amongst all the stuff we moved over here that shows people being hauled off to the guillotine, and they point to somebody and they say, "Take him first. He was our PR man."
Right.
So.
Okay. So it comes with the territory, but also, I mean, it's just fascinating how the the culture has just changed on that.
Well, I never worked in Bob Packwood's office, and I have the greatest respect for Bob Packwood. He and I got into a little debate at Trumpeters here the other day. Over, and I'm still following up on that to find out what people know, because I was not, you know, except for tangentially, not involved.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a reputation of encouraging that kind of survival of the fittest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whoever's toughest politically inside my office will be the one who will rise up, and that's the kind of people I want to surround myself with. Well, man, goodness, you end up eating your young, you know. I mean, it's just, I don't think that works.
Yeah.
That just doesn't work at all.
Yeah, and when the cards come down, who's going to defend you?
Yes,
exactly. As he found out.
As it turned out, yes, right.
I haven't talked to you since the service, because Bob was there, and I went up and talked to him and said, "Hi, I'm writing the biography. I'm going to need to talk to you. Here's my card." And, you know, and I told him, the governor said, you know, to write anything. If I find scandal, put it in. You know, if there's anything there, you know, go for it. And I turned around, and Elaine looked at me, and she said, "You know, great, you could write Bob's and get into that too." But she was making a joke.
Yes, right.
Like, not so Bob can hear.
Right.
But
well, you don't know if he can hear. I mean, he can't really see, he can't really hear. So.
Exactly. But some of the first humor that I've encountered from her, which was fun.
Hopefully she's mellowed over the years.
Yeah. It's actually 20 years ago, right about now, actually a little bit later in October, that I first talked to some of the powers that be who now run the Foroscope paper, because John Tragg was the managing editor at Willamette Week.
Oh.
And Elaine Franklin dropped the John Kitzhaber Smokes Pot just before the ballots in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first time that I, and John and I work together all the time because he's the publisher of the local paper.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, Elaine, there you are. Great. So
nowadays that'd be a positive.
Yeah, exactly. Especially given the ballot. when you write about the idea that you would be in all the meetings,
mm-hmm.
and then there's an implication in what you're writing that the governor didn't really understand all the implications of that condition. And then when you have your face-off with Paul Newman, and, you know, by gosh, this isn't going to happen, and then you say, well, you know, the governor may have met with Paul Newman.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there you go. So
what it removed,
uh-huh.
wasn't private meetings.
Uh-huh.
And because those happen.
Yeah.
But what it removed was the Trump that you come away with a private meeting with, which is, the governor and I have decided, so now begin implementing it. That could never happen again.
So it's not that private meetings don't happen, but that they're not the decision-making crux.
Right. What's the point in having a private meeting if whatever you get out of it is mm-hmm. meaningless?
Mm-hmm.
You don't come back to the campaign manager and say the candidate and the consultant have agreed to do X, and so do it. Well, no, you haven't, because I wasn't there, and it didn't happen if I wasn't there.
Right. Okay.
And so if you want to sit down and talk about it, well, no, and then, you know, you lose that.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it's all about.
Okay.
And it happened in 78. I mean, you can bring it up to Carol Whitney, who's now close by, mm-hmm. and she'll tell you exactly, you know, mm-hmm. how that used to happen. And it was, you know, consultants are supposed to push you. And as I've said many, many times, Paul Newman's a genius.
Mm-hmm.
He's just an absolute genius. But the idea of pushing you to a place where it doesn't work in Oregon, or it's simply not true, or the candidate will not agree with it,
mm-hmm.
that's what really good local staff are supposed to do. And I think we're seeing some campaigns in Oregon right now where that's not happening.
Yeah.
And so if you're putting together a team, you want to put together some really experienced professionals who've done 10,000 campaigns, but you also want the truth squad, if you will, the people mm-hmm. who kind of the breaks,
mm-hmm.
who go, wait a minute, we don't do that here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what it avoided, was the ability for the consultant to be doing things. And, you know, Paul had a phrase he used one time, and it just galled me. He said, you know, go ahead and say it and put it in the news release, and the governor will have to say it, or the
mm-hmm.
candidate. It was mm-hmm. mostly in 78 because it didn't happen in 82.
Yeah.
But I learned a lot from Paul Newman.
Yeah.
I learned a whole lot from Paul Newman. And I'm just glad that he finally saw some numbers changing and decided he'd get back involved in the campaign.
To parachute back in.
Yeah.
Fascinating story about you using blatant influence to clear the Highway 101 for the Western Governor's Conference.
Oh, yeah. I've got to find out who was the director of the Department of Transportation.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I've got to get the blue book out or something. And mm-hmm. it makes the story a little richer if I actually have a name.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it was like everybody. When we had it set up, Paul Phillips was in charge, who you know well,
mm-hmm.
Was in charge of transport. And so we had this cadre of state police unmarked cars and meet people at the airport, and because we didn't want to put governors behind, you know, screens and
right.
things. And so we had a lot of every unmarked car the state police had, every captain's car they had,
mm-hmm.
and they had their own cars waiting for them. Many governors literally played the presidential model and had their cars shipped in. It was just like bizarre. How do you have money to do that in the Western governors, especially?
Yeah.
I mean, New Jersey is one thing. And the first report I got was, you know, the entire, and you know what the intersection I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's that big open left turn lane, you know, mall on the right and Salesian on the left, and they'd torn it all up. It was like one lane with a flag car each direction, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going like, and it's the only time that I can't, you know, this dotted line business is so important. You have to respect that authority that you are given.
Yeah.
And if you abuse it, you'll get reeled in real quickly, or you'll get ignored by the bureaucracy.
Right.
And I don't remember any other time when I really, in a demanding sort of way, called up a state agency head and said, do this, do it now. But in this case, they obviously, they would have done it. All I had to do was explain what was going on, and they would have decided it. But, you know, I remember the words. I mean, it was like, you have the strongest and or the most robust radio system in the state of Oregon, because they did, between the state police and the Department of Transportation. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be by today's standards. And I said, and can you make this problem go away? And he said, I'm hanging up the phone now, implying that that's the next thing I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And it wasn't 7 or 8 minutes that they were starting to pick up their gear and get the heck out of the intersection.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. That was great power to do the obvious.
Yeah, to do the obvious.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, Fond Intersection. KXL used to pay me with a script.
Oh, really?
And which was, you know, we can't eat at that many restaurants. I was giving away hundreds of dollars of stuff to people, donating it to charities, to
auctions,
you know, all that
yeah.
kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But we kept all the stuff from Salishan.
Of course.
So for the last, like, 4 years, we've gone there for a wonderful, expensive 3 days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that intersection very well.
Okay. You, of course, reported that on your taxes.
Oh, of course. No, I had to, because one of the people I used to sing in a really good choir, he's a CPA, and he said, do it.
Yeah.
And then KXL only caught up with that, like, 2 years after they started it.
Yeah.
And they got 1099s. Their numbers were wrong, but I was able to, you know, I was on top of that. So this is something that comes up a little bit in the governor's stuff. Jerry talked a little bit about it. You got it as well. Atiyah's temper behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like? You have a specific thing over the Sweet Home Lebanon scheduling snafu, driving back and forth across the side of the valley.
Remember it well.
But what was that anger like? Because, you know, in public, he's, you know, as governor, it's not quite what we heard from Suzanne at the service where he was the state's grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the even keel guy.
Well, my grandpa had a temper.
but he was the even keel guy.
Yep.
So talk to me about that temper. Was it instrumental? Was it blowing off steam? Was it, you know,
I guess
short? I mean,
I would describe it as a hyper level of sternness.
Okay.
On the story you're using as an example, which again I can tell you, outside the exhibit hall of the old Memorial Coliseum, where we were standing and where the concrete post was, and you know, it's one of those memories that gets burned in your brain.
Yeah.
And we're standing out there, and he's, you know, told me that I will meet him on Sunday morning, and at a time that was really odd, and so on and so forth, and he went through the scenario very, this, and then we did this, and then we did that, and you know, basically that I would know how incredible, because I didn't know what the real issue was until I started talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then his close was, and this will not happen again, right? And I go, well, I don't know yet. No, this will not happen again, right? He said, that's right, Governor, it will not happen again.
Mm-hmm.
But I will also find out what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, you've got a problem and you don't know why it was a problem, and you don't know if it was your scheduler. And as I think I have said, it wasn't the scheduler. It was pressure from Glenna Hayden in his office that did it.
The pictures.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, and I don't believe that until 10 years ago, maybe. I mean, eventually I told the governor.
Mm-hmm.
But again, maybe this circles back to your first question. There's just nothing in my being that would hang out Glenna to dry over that.
Yeah.
And so you make what you say is, and I did. I followed up with him much later and said, I know where the problem occurred. It will not happen again, and it was not with Carol G, who was the scheduler.
Right.
And he said, that's all I need.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. But it would have been real easy to have brought down Glenna.
Right.
As part of that process, because everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah.
But in this case, what I did was simply get back to Glenna and say, Glenna, don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, please. And I told Carol, if you ever have anything like that come up, I'll back you up, and that solved the problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was his angry as I have seen him. I've not seen him. He would get very unhappy with leaks,
mm-hmm.
and we would deal with leaks. He wanted to know who leaked this story.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that's really hard to find out. And he said, well, then I don't give you easy jobs. You know, find out what happened. And mm-hmm. then I suggested the mechanism of flushing dye down the toilet, and we began to find out who we could trust and who we couldn't
right.
on the staff. And they stopped getting information
mm-hmm.
in some cases. In other cases, they kept getting it, kept leaking it. But
mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I never saw him absolutely blow up.
Mm-hmm.
But he would get hyper stern.
Hyper stern, yeah.
Yeah, and you knew because he would be talking slower and he would be looking right at you and
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. And the time when the story he tells, first person or present tense, story he used to tell about he was involved in the early budgets and the guy said, you know, whatever, it's only $60,000, you know, can't we move on? We're dealing here with millions. And he reeled in that guy or reined him in and basically said, if that was in your checking account, would that be a serious amount of money? And
mm-hmm.
I said, well, yes, Governor. He said, well, then we're going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everybody got the word
exactly.
on that.
We're clear on that.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
He
was not mercurial.
No, I didn't get that sense. Jerry described it as also very rare, but she said in one case that she was talking about, it's like his eyes turned black. You can just see his pupils getting big as a whoosh, you know. But the
and he was hypersensitive with her. I'm sure she's told you this about, you know, because he'd been dealing with Lee Johnson,
yeah,
who would give him a whole series of oh by the ways all the time,
right,
and just be doing things, you know,
yeah.
without ever even checking. And
yeah.
Jerry knew that and was on top of it. But there was a time when he'd been away for a month or whatever, and there was no way for him. And Jerry kept notes about,
yeah.
I briefed you on this day, and I talked to you on the phone on this day, and somewhat defensive. But then once he got through that and realized that it was, then she got a lot more leash to
yeah.
run with
yeah.
because he didn't think he was dealing with Lee Johnson the second.
Yeah, exactly. But building that trust.
Yeah.
And it's not just building it, but its actions have got to be there.
And nothing, by the way, takes away from arguing strenuously,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And really strenuously arguing back and forth, because we were encouraged to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I may be repeating myself, but what I want to surround myself with is very bright people who know their job and who work really, really hard and who have the guts to be able to say, with all due respect, Governor, you're full of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that.
Mm-hmm.
On a routine basis. And he said, I didn't want any yes men around. And then it was the time when we kept arguing. He said, but can't you say yes once in a while? and I may have again told you this story, but there was a time when I really disagreed with him. And
mm-hmm.
and he was just flat out wrong. And he had done something that had undercut me in some way, shape, or form. It was not just an issue or a strategy. It was personal. And I chewed him out inappropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And left and went stomping back to my office and realized that I'd made a terrible mistake and that I was serving at the pleasure of the governor and he wasn't very pleased
mm-hmm.
and walked back to his office and I apologized and I said, you know, I'm sorry. The way I put all of that was absolutely inappropriate to my friend and my governor and I apologized for the way I put it. And I started to walk away and I said, you're still wrong, but I should never have said it that way.
Uh-huh.
Grinned, and that was the only time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Just as you're saying that,
mm-hmm.
This is, you know, a question that would have been great to ask him because he loved Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous story about Abraham Lincoln with his cabinet meeting, and they go around and they vote, and the cabinet votes no, 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 no. It comes around, and it's like 9-1 because
mm-hmm.
Lincoln's the
mm-hmm.
only yes. The ayes carry it.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, you're the decider.
Yep.
It's your job.
Yep.
So let's get into a little bit of the meat of the campaign, tracking surveys.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the idea come from? The reason I ask is you're using Reagan's polling company, the DMI people. And Reagan by 81, we really knew about it after the assassination attempt, kind of the summer of 81. He was using that daily tracking polling for governing, which had never been done before.
And it's insane.
Yeah, yeah, and but he was someone who could almost carry it off. You can argue the second term, everybody's second term.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you ever run for a second term as president? But in any case, they do. But So where did that idea come from for the daily trekking polling? Was that from DMI? Was that you guys? Was that?
First of all, we changed pollsters. I believe we're with MOR before, and when Paul Newman was willing to give us some of his time, even if it was over the phone, I remember him saying, you know, and in fact there is a memo someplace that I have, and I'm going through all this stuff, so hopefully, I don't know what your timeline is on your project, but I'm trying hard to get stuff that I think would be interesting for you to see. And it's one where Paul Newman talks to Jerry Thompson about me being hired, and Jerry's writing the governor a letter. And Paul starts off by saying, well, I don't understand why Denny's not making this phone call. And so he was being supportive of me, which is great, you know, kind of thing. And then he was dissing our current polling that had been done in the primary. Well, pollsters get to know consultants, and consultants tend to want to go with the ones. And I don't know if there was something coming back around or not, or if he was part of something else. And I don't care. But in terms of tracking, it was part of the package.
And
tracking, I mean, you have the benchmark, and then you have the tracking, and then you have the follow-up or the backfire or what all the terms that are used nowadays, and to see how things are going. But, you know, we literally could see how an ad was having an impact, because we were doing, a rolling 200 or 300 or whatever it shows in here. And so every 4 days or 5 days, we would get a 600 sample combined. And that's just like wonderful stuff to have. And I loved it. And I had we didn't have it in 78. We couldn't afford it. But it's such a small part of the budget when you've got a bigger budget, as we did as a general election campaign in 82, that you, why not do it? And I honestly don't know what kind of polling Kulongoski's campaign had. Whether they knew the radio window was a problem or not. They didn't react like they knew it was a problem. But if we had not had, I'll just answer it straight out. If we had not had tracking, the biggest mistake I made in the 82 campaign could have lost it for us. It certainly would have been 15 points closer. And so I ate it like dinner. I mean, I would go home and make up a scotch, and we had an in-kind contribution of a condo down in John's Landing, and I would just sit there and gobble it up and divide it out and look at it. I knew just enough about statistics to be dangerous, but I also learned a lot, because these people would talk about, you know, Q factors and not just standard deviation, which I did know about, but some of these other things that they do in polling, and you'd sit there and talk to the pollsters and, wow, you just could figure out all sorts of things. We weren't doing regression or anything really exciting, but we were doing good stuff with those numbers.
Yeah, but when you're getting the daily stuff, you're in effect building your own regression in real time. And so,
And what you've got is you've got Paul Newman, who's done a bazillion campaigns, and you've got the pollsters who have looked at numbers for, you know, decades, and they know what they're doing in terms of that. And in those days, the sampling techniques were simpler than they are today, because you'd be able to make phone calls, and you knew where people were, and you had much more confidence than what we try to do today. And you could get a quick turnaround. And so, yeah, it was just wonderful data to have.
Okay.
And you also learn real quickly not to get too scared if it did.
Yeah.
You know, the daily stuff, when you're looking here at the dailies, you know, it's all over the place. But then you think, no, that's a very small sample. And the numbers are a lot different
at
600.
Look at a week, or look at you know, 2 weeks. There's some minimum line is the trend there. Don't worry if there's one here and one there.
And let me say one other thing. And I know we've got a limited amount of time, but the other policy that we had was not to share any of those numbers with the candidate. And that was important, because you don't want the candidate overreacting and panicking and things like that. You wanted to be the one to not be able to sleep or take the Tums and that kind of stuff. You didn't want the candidate doing that, because you wanted him on point during the campaign. Having said that, you've heard a lot from a lot of different sources, and so it's nothing that I have to convince you of. This guy knew what was going on in his state because he was out in it, because he had people out there that he'd known since 74 who would send him a note or call him up, and he was accessible. He was not insulated from what was going on. And so he knew he was doing well, or he knew when things were down a little bit, depending upon what part of the state he was in. And in addition to that, he had a secret method not so secret, but a secret method, and that was that when I would play him a radio ad, and the one time that I remember, he was in the North Bend airport, and we played him the radio ad, and he said, fine, go with it. And then there was this pause, and he said, took a dip in the tracking, huh?
There you go.
It was a little tougher. You know, yeah. A little more punch in that radio ad. And
yeah.
So he had his own tracking system. It was depending upon what, you know, I was deciding needed to go out on the air. And I didn't tell him, you know, how many gross rating points we'd upped or done something else or targeted in certain geographic areas. But again, he knew what was going on.
Yeah.
That was a secret to his success.
And that gets back to, you know, another thing that I wish I could ask him to really get it. He had these gut feelings all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I shared with you that his statewide races were Donnybrook's and Good Fun, but in his legislative races, he only had one that he, you know, had any problem with whatsoever.
Right.
And so
but he did have demographics and party registration.
He had all that stuff, but it's, you know, how do you develop that basically when there's really no need to develop it?
Right.
And so that gets back to him, his personality, his view of the world. His understanding, you know, all those kinds of things.
The difference is that and you've seen this, I think, because you've been around him when he's been in crowds and things mm-hmm. like that. The difference is, and you've seen a lot of other really good Oregon elected officials that no matter the party, they work a room differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would suggest that he worked a room more like Ron Wyden would work a room
mm-hmm.
than a Bob Packlett or even a Mark Hatfield would work mm-hmm. a room. It was engaged directly and seriously with someone and not be looking over somebody's shoulder, who else should he shake?
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do good at remembering names. I don't do good at remembering names, mm-hmm. but he didn't need that because he would remember who they were and be able to talk about something that was of interest to them. And he truly did engage with people and listen to them and not just try to convince them to continue support or to give him money or whatever the case might be.
Right.
And I would compare that with what I see Ron Wyden doing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's very good at that, and it's genuine.
Yeah.
And I disagree with Ron Wyden on issues probably mm-hmm. 90% of the time,
mm-hmm.
but I really respect how serious he is about really engaging with Oregonians,
yeah.
whether it's a town hall meeting or a one-on-one or whatever it might be.
And he's back in the good old days. I mean, he's the one who did an experimental campaign to do an experimental campaign.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he won.
Yeah.
And so, boom, he became a member of Congress.
Yeah.
But he was doing that just to basically say, I'm thinking of doing this someday.
Yeah.
Let's run a campaign
right.
to figure out how to do it. If it were these days, he'd run it and say, oh, he didn't do it. He'd disappear.
Someplace in all these boxes over here, I actually have my personal Xerox copy of the original Packwood manual on how to win a legislative race.
Yeah.
It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
And Wyden was the only person that we visited with back in Washington, D.C., who was just, of course, he was early in his terms mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, but boy, we were treated with respect. I mean, with Weaver, God, it was terrible. We would meet with him walking down the hall and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. And with Hatfield, it was never, I think maybe one time it was actually with the senator. Mm-hmm. Most of the time it was with Jerry Frank or somebody else, mm-hmm. you know, that would, oh, it's the governor, fine, all right. And that's just because, you know, he was powerful position, had a lot of things to do, I guess, but Wyden, he met us in the outer office, he came in, he'd lean over, he says, Governor, what can we do for Oregon today?
Mm-hmm.
And that's his attitude.
Yeah.
And again, I'd probably disagree with Senator on a lot of things, but boy, I respect him for mm-hmm. for that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know of anybody else right now that I would put in that category.
Mm-hmm. They don't have that same thing.
Yeah.
And then there's a personality. There was, I can't remember who it was, there was a legislator in Washington County who was just awful. He's one of the guys who, he basically had his own landscaping business, which is basically spreading bark dust.
Mm-hmm.
And so he milked the mileage because that was his source of income and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, ugh. But the, boy, the cities loved him because he'd do the same thing. He'd come into the mayor of Hillsboro.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, look, on the committee, they're going to be distributing a little bit extra money to cities. If I can get $1 million for Hillsboro, what's Hillsboro going to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he didn't win re-election. You know, he just wasn't good at that, but that kind of stuff, he was there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now we get to the elements of political campaign, pages 110, 101 to 111.
we should explain for history that I began writing a, I don't know, it's 1,000 pages now or some ridiculous length because I include so much data. When my wife Molly died in 1998, I began, first of all, I began journaling, and that was depressing because you'd read over your most intimate thoughts and, you know, you'd do nothing but cry. And because I lost her after just 5 months of marriage. But then I just began writing down everything I could remember about Molly and my relationship with her and all the stories and things like that. And when I ran that course, the natural place was then to start with my political side of things. And it's a document that is not public. It's not a public document. And it's a document that has been shared with you so that you would have ways of asking me questions.
Mm-hmm.
But since it's got stuff in it that is just very personal and things like that, I may or may not give you everything. I'm not going to lie to you, but I'm certainly going to evade or not give you everything. But it helps you with coming up with these questions. So
yeah.
Otherwise, people will wonder, what do you mean, page whatever?
Yeah, so and so forth. Exactly. So you have the element of a political campaign, elements of political campaign is laid out like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just use those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5s?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There's kind of names scattered in and out, and they're kind of irrelevant to everything.
Yeah. No, that's just that was me doing an we did a 6-page after action report on the memorial service.
Yeah.
You know, it's like what did we learn from this, and how did it really play out, and how did it come together? And absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
And a lot of that also, I mean. There was material that I gave you that was, other people sort of looking at it in a critical way and coming up with how things came together and that sort of thing. And a lot of people look at that 82 campaign, not because of all the wonderful things that I did.
Mm-hmm.
I take credit for the leadership and putting together a good team of people and keeping them on the straight and narrow. And I mean, I didn't make any serious personnel changes when I came in. I elevated people like Diana Daggett from, you know, a chain-smoking, non-typing secretary to associate campaign manager when it was all over because there was an incredible talent there that has proven itself now with Intel. Mm-hmm. But I didn't there was one person who was doing press that we let go before I got there because I was going to do the press. Mm-hmm. It wasn't because she was incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was just we did it the way it should be done.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, didn't go into debt, and we didn't say do terrible nasty things, and we were well organized, and so yeah, it's the kind of thing that you put together what really makes that happen.
Yeah.
And as we know, it's the last time, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That for Republicans, it's the. Yeah. I mean, Gordon Smith did a different kind of campaign for statewide office.
Right.
Didn't do it the same way. Of course, it was a different time as well.
Different time, and they had to contend with what the heck vote by mail did.
Exactly, because nobody really knew.
Nobody had any idea.
Right.
We were all learning together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see every 2 years I have my parties and elections class where they all have to go out and work in campaigns. And I'm just looking at things like elements of political campaign with the stuff that the governor has that I've talked to him about that's in his, you know, there's 2 years from now, there's a great week of, so here's kind of inside a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you make these decisions? Why do you not make these decisions?
Yep.
You know, how do you go? Just a really, really cool thing.
I'd love to have you get all the people who've been involved in the U.S. Senate race on the Republican side and the governor's race on the Republican side, and they all seem to be, you know, get fired here and go to work here. And you know, how many of them are, I mean, Michael Murphy, who was manager of Kulongoski's campaign, he left the state, I think, on election night.
Mm-hmm.
He was gone, and he's still a consultant back in D.C. someplace, if you can find him.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got to have some sort of local connection.
Exactly.
I think. Something. Yeah. You got to have outside experts, but some.
Yeah, Anyway. Absolutely. Talk to me. I want to really peg down your impression of the May primary election night. This is when the governor walks over to the Kulongoski campaign and challenges them to debate.
Right.
You have challenge in quotation marks. The governor, when I talked to him about it, said that his staff was unanimous that he shouldn't do it.
Did he walk over?
That's what he says.
I remember him doing it, but I thought he did it, like, on TV.
Well, you know, he said what he says is he walked over, it was, you know, 4, 5, 6 blocks, whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
He walked over there, and he walked in, and he happened to walk in right when all the TV was there going live.
Boy, so I have every channel that night on tape. And I have, in fact, watched it. I have 82 every channel. I've got something on, from 78. I'm sorry, we're talking about 82.
You were talking about 82, yeah, the primary night.
Yeah, I've got every, I've got three channels. Because I had three people running their VCRs.
Exactly.
And I've got the original tapes, and eventually they'll get over there. But and that's where I get some of the dialogue with some of the, you know, oh, come on, the verbose Portland State.
Oh, Marco Hagg.
Marco going, yeah. No. Back to you, you know, kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
And all this other kind of bizarre stuff. But the, I don't remember him physically going over there.
Okay.
But I do remember that, that he was going to challenge him right away. Mm-hmm. And we weren't so much opposed to it. If it was more a matter of, you know, it's for an incumbent who is not necessarily the most dynamic speaker in the world against somebody who had a lot of skill in that area. Mm-hmm. He was poorly coached, I think, in his debates, in my opinion. But still, the right thing to do is to not give your less-known opponent that stage as much as possible. Now, I will tell you that as part of my negotiating strategy with Ted Kulongoski's labor union lawyer, legal partner, and Michael Murphy, I said, I hope this negotiation breaks down. And in those days, it's not like they're doing now where, you know, they run unilaterally. We agreed up front that the main thing was that we were going to be in control of our debates. They were ours. They weren't the League of Women Voters. They weren't the city clubs. They weren't KGWs. They were our debates. Right. And that otherwise, we would lose control of them. That was the very first thing we agreed to. Mm-hmm. And then I said, when we got to some impasse or whatever, and, you know, they wanted 10 and I wanted none, and I said, good. They said, well, we're far apart. I said, that's good for me. I said, I just as soon have no debates. As long as this negotiation, I said, we've set a deadline as to when we're going to agree by, and that when that goes away, because part of their strategy was to run it closer to the election, and our strategy was to have it farther away from the election, and they bought that. And it was a total ruse, because I knew the governor was going to debate, and I knew we... I think the only thing that we didn't get that we thought we were going to get was something in Bent. And, you know, they thought they had just kicked butt because they'd got Medford and Eugene and Portland. Well, I don't know if he told you this story or not, but pissed off every labor person in Medford because they brought in all the goons from Portland and the local labor down in Medford all voted for Atiyah as a result of that. And so, yeah, it was you know, a poor choice right there. And at the Portland one, you know, Ted was stuffy. He wasn't himself. He wasn't comfortable. He'd been overcoached, and he didn't really know the issues that well. And, you know, we just did extremely well in all the debates. I think we probably didn't do as well in Eugene, but we did well certainly in Medford and Portland. And you could see it in the numbers.
Okay. Oh, this is just a aside to tell you, when you already mentioned this, I really appreciated your acknowledging the limitations of polling. When you were talking about, you know, what's a statistical tie, all that kind of stuff. In Europe, when they publish polls, they always have gray areas. So if it's red and blue, they will blend together. So you can see, you know, actually, this is the reality.
Right.
It's not point to point.
Right.
It's this.
Yeah, well, I've got a book over here in my rather ostentatious book collection called How to Lie with Statistics. And it's very easy to do, of course, and you can leave an impression. I mean, these ones where they, you know, people click on a box and on a website, those are the ones that are the most bizarre. It's just unbelievable. And nowadays, I think people have become so cynical about polling because 90% of the calls I get that even look like a poll are basically voter ID calls anyway, or they're push polls. And people don't even really understand what's going on even in a push poll, a real push poll. So, you know, there are push questions, which are legit, and then there are push polls, which are just robocalls.
So. They're crazy. They're crazy. So let's talk about that 1982 radio window mistake. So the radio window was part of the original plan.
Well, yes and no. The original plan, and there really isn't a document. If I'd have been around the primary, there would have been a binder, because I'm a binder freak. But there wasn't. But the plan was, in effect, dominate the media in terms of paid media, raise a ton of money and dominate it. The only two instructions that I had from the governor when he cornered me into accepting the job was win and don't leave me in debt no matter what. And he envisioned this was going to be his last campaign. And that if he won, it would be difficult to pay off, but possible to pay off a debt. If he lost, it would be coming out of his family's inheritance or the business or something. And and he just, was very, very clear on that to me. And this was echoing in my head. So you're faced as a manager with, cash flow coming in and cash flow going out, and you have to hit it just perfect. You've got to hopefully be at zero. And your biggest asset at the end of the campaign in those days was the telephone deposit. And so you literally budgeted that you were going to get 10 grand back, and 10 grand was a lot of money in those days, from Pacific Northwest Bell. When you shut down your telephone system, they would give you a check, and you'd use that for your last payroll. And, I mean, you just literally budgeted that. And so I was in a situation where the polling looked really pretty good. The tracking was, as I've shared that with you, and you can see it. And the money was okay, but it wasn't for sure. And so we thought, gosh, radio's been a really good thing to us, and we can hit key markets that way and so on and so forth. And so let's get ready for a final push that'll start, such and such a date, and we'll backfill with extra buys in radio. And since it's before the real climax of the campaign, it shouldn't hurt us. Well, it hurt immediately. And it shows a couple things. It shows how I didn't know what I was doing, and that with that in regard to that, it shows that television continues to be king when it comes to statewide campaigns. And we probably should have pulled off of radio and just hung in there with television at the time. And it shows how hard it is to correct a mistake like that, because there's so much momentum built into these things and so much lead time. And, we had avails nailed down for the end of that, but to find some avails and get back on the air with anything, we were once again on no offense to KPTV, but we were on independent television stations at 1 a.m. And it didn't help, as you can see from the from the polling. And then it takes, it's like a use your metaphor, it's like a battleship, it's like a train. Once you bring it to a halt, then you have to get it going again. And when you, and it took a while for that to build up and that critical mass to build up. And then, of course, once we did that, we were able to just go to town. But, boy, it was scary. I think the phrase I use in my personal journals, if you will, or notes or minutes or whatever those things are, writings, driving down to Medford and just said, keep smiling, don't let them see you sweat. And I didn't know if they had that or not. And they didn't act like they did. And you pretty much have to see what other people are doing to see what, and they were doing that with us. I know they were trying to see, and we were trying to fake them out with things that they didn't know that we were trying to. I mean, it's like World War II, for God's sake. I mean, there's a huge metaphor between military battles and political campaigns. But, I was sick to my stomach for a week and a half. I thought I'd just made the silliest mistake. I did. I made the silliest mistake in the entire campaign. And it was correctable, thank goodness. But it was stupid. And I was in charge of that. I mean, I could make those decisions. That wasn't Paul Newman. Paul Newman produced wonderful ads. And that was his major kind of, and he was great on strategy and conversations with him on the phone and things like that. When he came to town, we used him to produce television. The radio ads were produced by a guy from Olympia, his name has escaped me, but he was kind of a junior consultant, and he was great too, and helped with script writing, and we would sit, midnight in some studio someplace editing them down, including the lady who sounded like she was 105 years old, and she was only like 37 or 38, but she had this one, Ted Kulongoski's policies are dangerous. But yeah, that's, I don't know, I forget your question now, but
No, that's
it's like a nightmare to me. It really is a nightmare, because as much as you get excited when you see the numbers, going like this, you get nauseous when they all of a sudden do this, right, and almost come within the margin of error being tied.
Yeah.
And you think, you know, these ads are the same ads that caused us to go up. The only thing different is we're not running them anymore. And so that's if the tracking was worth anything, it was recognizing that mistake and being able to correct it in time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, this is also something I'm hoping 2 years from now to have developed. The campaign ads are so important, but the repetition and the keeping things out there is so important as
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you saw the Oregonian story that actually used me about the Seneca ads for Richardson. They're just bizarre ads. They don't mention Kulongoski. They just have, remember the website, Bhutan, Elliot.
No, they don't mention Kulongoski. I mean, because of Kitzhaber.
Kitzhaber. They don't mention Kitzhaber at all. They don't mention Richardson at all. They just have those things up there. And it doesn't say Cover Oregon. It says the website. And so there's great big billboards all around Portland that are like, it's like encountering a Zen campaign or something.
Well,
and I saw one. There's one right by where I go to my Home Depot, and I saw it and said, I got to come back here with my iPad and take a picture for my student, because we've just been talking about name recognition, you know, signs. There's evidence of signs versus calling versus all this other kind of stuff. This is great because it breaks all those rules, and it's going to go nowhere.
Somebody's making a lot of money off it, though.
Well, it's $200,000 in kind donation.
Yeah.
So.
And it's one of those ones that Richardson can't say anything about or have any control over,
no,
kind of thing.
No.
Well, what about the Webby ad? And is it, maybe it's an ad again. It's one of those independent expenditure ads, but it's the gay ad, for want of a better term.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to Barbara, who is, you know, a liberal Democrat and the love of my life and all this kind of stuff, but she doesn't particularly like talking about politics. We're watching it, and she said, why don't you like that ad? It would seem like that would be a good ad. And I said, well, because I think there's a whole lot of Republicans that are not engaged enough to know, you know, who is running against whom.
Mm-hmm.
And they will vote, in fact, for Merkley because he must be the anti-gay person, and they're anti-gay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they think gay rights is a ruse or whatever it is, and she's, you know, wrapping herself around that issue. And I think she's going to lose some of her base.
Yeah, I think
based on that ad. Now, if they brought up the other guy,
mm-hmm,
and said, you know, somehow or other, you know, as a result, Merkley's not your best choice or something like that, but they don't.
No.
They just say she's the pro gay candidate.
Yeah.
So I'll bet you there's 20% of the Republican vote that's affected by that in a negative way.
Yeah.
Because they're not engaged enough to know the difference.
And because she hasn't spent her money, and what little money she hasn't spent it wisely to say, this is who I am.
Right.
We have nothing to play against.
No, there's
that's
been
That's why the plagiarism and all that kind of stuff, that's all we know about you.
Right.
You haven't defined
She was an empty vessel until the op research people filled that vessel with their,
exactly,
with their stuff. So.
Exactly. Let's see here. This is actually my favorite part about the radio window, and then the things that came right after that. So Kulongoski calls for the end of the dangerous ad, and you guys were going to, it had lived its life anyway, but you had to leave it on the air extra days.
This is all around Medford as well.
Yeah.
I'm in Medford. I'm at the Red Lion. And the phone call comes in from Associated Press or something like that, and, you know, Kulongoski's called a news conference, and you know, it was fun because he'd complained about it before, and I would get media inquiries,
mm-hmm,
and of course, all of a sudden, you got earned media coming out your ears with, mm-hmm, you able to say, no, first of all, we don't call him dangerous, mm-hmm, we call his policies dangerous, and I have the scripts to prove it, and he knows exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, he's not running our campaign. And number right, three, there's nothing more dangerous than the plant closing bill. Now, the question you have to ask Governor Kulongoski is, who in the hell named it a plant closing bill in the first place?
Yeah.
Because that's just like we were just talking about, that people, again, are not that engaged. They didn't know what that was.
Mm-hmm.
And we took that to an advantage.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said, they're calling me a union lawyer. You know, well, we tested all the words and came up with the one that sounded the most negative. But, mm-hmm, yeah, we basically then, because we know that he knew because you know what kind of things are running out there, because you have people in radio stations and elsewhere that tell you this one's going to end on such and such
right.
a day.
Right.
And hindsight, at the time I actually didn't even think that through, but hindsight told me that he knew what was going to stop running and that the dangerous ad was going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so you call a news conference, say, they need to stop this ad, and it stops, and he calls another news conference, says, he did the right thing, you know, it was
right.
stupid and wrong and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I'm literally on a weekend getting the PSW media buyer at home,
mm-hmm.
and having home numbers in your wallet, by the way, is a good idea for all campaign mm-hmm. managers, and nowadays, cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, there weren't any cell phones. And said, you know, you got to get down and you got to get me some avails. And she said, well, nobody's around. I said, figure out a way, you know, that you got to get back and tell them that tape needs to continue to run, even if you have to call each radio station, because it was a radio ad.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot pull that off,
mm-hmm.
and at least for another week. Well, what do you want me to do with these others? Just, we can run them together, we can rotate them, but it cannot come off the air. And it didn't come off the air as a result of that. But yeah, it was scheduled to go away right then, and I think he knew.
Mm-hmm.
I think he knew.
Yeah.
He won't know whether he knew or not, but Michael Murphy might
right.
know,
right.
and somebody at the tactical level might know.
Yeah.
But and then Ted might know for all.
Yeah.
You know, that's a possibility. But yeah, it was just a classic situation. Yeah. We loved it whenever he would complain about it,
mm-hmm.
because we got to talk about it and we didn't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, please. Don't throw me in that briar patch, you know?
Exactly. So talk about the advertising dominance of the last 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Strategic media buys, keep Kulongoski out of the better time slots.
Mm-hmm.
Was this also part of this is part of your original plan?
To literally dominate.
To dominate that last 3 weeks.
Right. Right. And of course, you knew it was just going to be election day. It's totally different now. But
yeah.
But the... And I don't, I believe, I mean, I have, I don't know if I gave that to you or not, but in terms of did I give you a copy of the actual buy?
I don't remember that.
Okay, well, I have it, and I can give it to you, but it shows where and what was being bought at what time. And it's, anyway... It literally shows how many gross rating points of television and how many dollars were being spent by both sides and where they were being spent. And it's in, you know, television, radio, Atiyah, mm-hmm. Kulongoski. And they were struggling with cash, and so not only did they not get good avails, they were forced into buying just whatever was available with whatever cash they could bring in toward the end.
Mm-hmm.
And any polling that anybody was doing by then, you know, if... The perfect storm for us negatively and for them positively would have been, you know, AFL-CIO does a big backfire poll at the middle of the radio window and tons of cash comes flowing in and they're able to equal us in the last part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that didn't happen. They literally ended up running out of money and running out of steam toward the end, and we were increasing. Roy Livermore was, you know, bless his soul. He was so conservative and so nervous about this and so on. And that's great. That's what you want in a treasure, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Diana and Roy and I would sit there and we'd go over the books and approve things and look at how the spreadsheet was going and that kind of stuff. And he said, okay, well, now, you know, you're coming up. You can't do any more now. And I said, well, I might go over a little bit, but I think we're okay because this is coming in and the vice president or not the former president's going to be here or something like that was going to happen. Okay, and he'd agree with it. And so, but in the last 10 days, it was like, well, we need to spend some more money. Is there a way? Because he was so excited because he did see the tracking, and
yeah.
He was one of the few that did.
Yeah.
And I said, see what this gross rating point, 100 gross rating points did this kind of thing. And then toward the end, he said, well, let's just go out and raise some more money and spend it, you know, kind of thing. He went from Mr. Fiscal Conservative to Mr. Let's just blow him out of the water, you know,
yeah.
kind of guy.
Yeah.
And a miraculous personality transformation, even after we stole $81 million from safe.
Exactly. So, but it worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
The only trouble we got into was from other candidates who thought we took their money away from them. Well,
yeah.
I just smile. Mm-hmm. I mean, hey, it's your job to raise money, and we didn't take any money away from you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this ends up being a historic win,
right,
in terms of the size. To what do you attribute the final? I mean, you knew you were doing well after some, you know, the summer was bad. We were turning things around early on. We're turning things around. But when things are turned around, you're okay. There's the dip with the radio window. To what do you attribute the huge final victory? I mean, talking to a couple of other people, hardcore Democrats, they were saying, geez, you know, by the end, even Ted Kulongoski's mother wouldn't vote for him. And so they're talking, I think, the quality of the ads and you know, the impression they left with people is what they're responding to. And one thing, would love to see your scripts, but we also have all the television stuff. So part of my budget is going to be converting all that television stuff into digital, so yeah, I can watch all this stuff.
Yeah, you get three books.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I hope, by the way, as an aside, I'll answer your question, but I hope as an aside that I've said this many times to you, and that is write independently and write long.
Yeah.
And then the editors will kill you and go through and bring it down to a saleable level, a reasonable level. But everything you write should be available on a website someplace,
yeah,
and there should be hyperlinks back and forth to pictures. And I mean, you're putting together a definitive piece, and that's one of the reasons Packwood is kind of glum, and even Antoinette has said several times,
yeah,
why didn't we have it more open at Willamette?
Yeah.
And all of these people are saying, wow, this is being done right, you know, and that's wonderful. Here's what, and I've said this to you before, but I honestly believe this. The ads simply reminded people about this guy that they already knew really well. And they knew him really well, often because they'd met him,
mm-hmm,
or because they had been in a room with him, or they had observed him in some form or another. And you can produce the most brilliant ad in the world and try and convince voters that black is white and white is black, and they aren't, and it won't work.
Mm-hmm.
It may work just, you know, 1% or something, but it just won't work. But if you produce an ad that resonates, then it's going to be incredibly effective because the leverage kicks in at that point. Well, we produced ads that basically showed people what they already had a feeling for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the polling showed they kind of put some blame on him for not having improved the economy. You know, and so we put an ad out there that said, you know, let's be honest, this is happening at the national level and so on. And look what we're doing in Oregon. We're doing the right things and so on. And that resonated.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew that. Well, and he was in the news a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The weekly media availabilities that they were a creation, literally, of his request to me to make something up like that. The term I take credit for. But those were things that would give him regular press. And so people, those ads really just took what they already knew and felt. So when it came right down to them sitting in a voting booth and making a decision, it was Ted Kulongoski hasn't made the case that he's going to be better than this guy I already know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an incumbent campaign.
Yeah.
You know, you simply give them a reason to let them continue doing what he's been doing, because he hasn't done anything really terribly bad.
Right.
And that's a kind of a cynical way of looking at it, but. And that really, it's like in the springtime when the physics of limnology kick in on a high lake and it just reaches a certain point and then it goes like this because of the water temperature.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened in the last 3 weeks. I mean, it just literally, we just kept hitting it over and over again, repeating the messages over and over again, and people got in the voting booth. It wasn't like in the primary in the primary in 78 where it was like anti-McCall votes switching over,
right?
And that kind of, well, there wasn't a moment like that,
right?
But they knew this guy, and whether they ever met him or not, they knew this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And with great respect for Ted Kulongoski, who I think, you know, obviously won statewide twice, and has, you know, some of the broadest experience of any Oregon governor in various branches of government, you know, he wasn't doing that.
Yeah.
He thought, buy TV, win.
Mm-hmm.
Damaged governor, charismatic young man, buy TV, win. I mean, I'd love to compare schedules. If he'd give you a schedule, if he's got it even.
Yeah.
Because he didn't campaign that hard.
No.
And, you know, every time we went to a community, we did about 10 things.
Yeah.
We did at least, you know, 2 media stops, 1 radio station, 1 newspaper minimum. And if it was a bigger community, more than that. You know, a volunteer stop, a major speech. I mean, we had a certain checklist. Whenever mm-hmm. we went to a town of a certain size, we did certain things.
Yeah.
And he didn't do that.
Yeah, I'd love to look at that, too, because that's exactly how he ran his 2002 and 2006 campaigns,
mm-hmm.
which is weird, but effective.
Yeah, it worked.
He
worked.
Won. Yeah. So what the heck? So another permission thing, can mm-hmm. I use your Election Day memo on 129?
Yeah, that's a fun memo.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can run it, you can use it as a visual.
Yeah.
I mean, there is this point in a campaign where you don't have anything else you can do.
Exactly.
All right? You balance the budget. You look at the telephone deposit. You figure out how you're going to make the last payroll. Mm-hmm. You put a date on the calendar when the whole thing is going to close down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sit there.
Mm-hmm.
And you package up stuff into a banker's box, and you're done, kind mm-hmm. of thing. And so you can't buy any more ads. You can't get out the vote thing is working. It's already out there. The trigger's been pulled. You can't pull it back. You can't increase it. You've mm-hmm. worked on it for 6 months, and it's either going to happen or it's not going to happen. And so you sit down and you write the memo. And as I say in my writings, I had the benefit of hundreds of thousands of dollars of tracking information, and I hit it within, 2 or 3/10 of a percent of what it ended up being.
Yeah.
And both Jerry and the governor underestimated what they had them winning. Mm-hmm. Governor mm-hmm. knew he was going to win, but mm-hmm. I had it within a half a percentage point. So
mm-hmm.
that's great fun to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's very good.
Especially to start off with, you know, you're going to definitely do this, and then here's my prediction, and then line them up with what the Secretary of State said a month later and have it be that close.
Yeah, which is, it's fun because since I started doing this public stuff, I have a little contest with the Secretary of State on predicting turnout and stuff every
mm-hmm.
year. It's
mm-hmm.
fun. And I went back and I'm usually right about 80% of the time, and their office is usually right about 40% of the time.
Is that right?
Yeah. So it's just good fun.
Well, and the other thing is that, in my personal opinion, you are the one, quote, political science professor who understands political campaigns. And I mean, they're all nice people. And mm-hmm. even the retired ones, well, there's a couple of them that are not nice, but they're mostly, and they are academic political scientists.
Right.
Well, as you know, an academic political scientist looks at things completely differently.
You betcha.
Than an on-the-ground, tactical, strategic political campaign to win an election. And, you know, the kind of stuff, I'd love to go back and major in political science and learn all that stuff, but I didn't need to know that to win a campaign,
right.
And they don't need to know how to win a campaign to pontificate on something that you read that and you go like, what?
Yeah.
I won't even mention names, but you just, you know, excuse me?
No. I use some of the readings in my class, however. So there you go.
Uh-huh.
So let's go a little bit negative, and then I want to end on a really fun one here.
Well, I love my negative.
So the negative is not, you know, you can be negative if you want. But the influentials who wanted you out of the press job at the end of this campaign,
mm-hmm.
and you felt that there was a sweet spot where you basically got, you know, I'm coming back, and the governor said you're coming back, kind of before there was a flood of...
No, so we're talking... Post-campaign.
Post-campaign.
Okay, post-victory.
Yeah. So you know, it was the campaign manager job a way to ease you out of the press secretary job, but you ended up back there.
Well,
so.
Yeah. In general, I guess I'm pretty clear in my own mind that, well, first of all, I was gone for, you know, 2 weeks, and my top assistant was let go or moved to, you know, Tim Marsh,
mm-hmm.
who's wonderful. I mean, I hired Tim because he was who he was, and you hire people who are complementary to your skills.
Right.
And he didn't have my skills, and I didn't have his skills, and I only had one hire,
mm-hmm.
and so that's why I picked him. But he wasn't flashy at all, and I was the flashy guy. But there was every indication that there was a desire to completely cleaning the plate in the press office mm-hmm. before I was ever even hired on the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could have happened before the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was fortunate in some respects. I mean, it was like if the governor had accepted my no to the offer, in mm-hmm. air quotes, of being campaign manager, he might have said, oh, no, by the way, you're no longer press secretary. He wouldn't have said that.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't do those things. That somebody mm-hmm. else would do those things. So in some respects, I guess that had to figure into the back of my mind thinking. And it was a question of do you go out as the press secretary that in 4 years brought the governor to a position where he's going to lose horribly?
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's not true, but that's the impression. Right. That's the perception is reality. Or do you go out as the person who not only did that, but then managed the campaign that he lost by a record margin?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Hobson's choice, you know, really, yeah. in a true sense of the word. And at least by taking on the campaign, you had and winning with a record margin, I had a little more stock
mm-hmm.
in my portfolio. But even then, there was a phone call. And Jerry is truly my best friend,
mm-hmm.
lives a block and a half away, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And her take on it, because I've confronted her after you know, serious number of scotches at the country club and serious number mm-hmm. of vodkas in her case to have her warmed up to me kind of thing. And she swears that when we had this phone conversation, when I was in my condo down in John's Landing at the end after the victory,
mm-hmm.
and so on, that they were talking about like a promotion, you know, kind of thing, that I would maybe move up. And, well, you know, there was no jobs that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no jobs that would have looked like a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And all these jerks that had spread the rumor that I was on my way out would have been proven correct. And I liked what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
It was the best job I've ever had and ever will have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't want to do that. And I literally said, I have earned the right to come back as press secretary, and I want my job back.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this long pause, and, you know, that 1 or 2 days later, I was told I was coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was I didn't say it, but it was very clear that, you know, I was going to have to be promoted, if you will, to, you know, assistant agency head of some minor agency mm-hmm. by the governor himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to argue the point that I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you also get in a situation where if you come back and you're really not wanted, you're not effective either.
Yeah, exactly.
But my case was that you know, not only did I not cause him to lose in the 4 years that I was sort of communications, I was really communications manager for 3 years
mm-hmm.
because there was a half a year of campaigning and there was another half of year of Lee Johnson ignoring me.
Right.
And so, but during that period of time, I set up what turned out to be a record victory. So I took credit for that,
mm-hmm.
which is unusual for me. Really, it is. It was hard. But I said, so I did that, and then I did this.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what I do, and I do it well. And it turned out, he said modestly, that I did do
mm-hmm.
the last 4 years well and went on virtually all of the trips with the governor and, you know, right up until, you know, Wednesday, September 3rd, was staff member for life.
Yeah.
And so it played out that way.
Yeah.
The reality is that that's the way it turned out. But it kind of galled me that it was that the long knives were still out
yeah.
after that victory. And I kind of thought, I remember thinking and talking to Holly, my now ex-wife, that, you know, maybe I would do this for a year or so and then I would use it as a way to, you know, move up. Well, a year or so later, I'm still having a really good time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm effective at what I'm doing, and I'm getting to travel the world
mm-hmm.
with the governor because I take pictures and I help him, and I'm a good gopher kind of staff person. And so I ended up staying the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out really, 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 really well.
Yeah.
I don't know if I told you the anecdote after the memorial service, but I was back, and I've lost my blue binder. It really bothers me, the planning binder. It's, mm-hmm. it's a historical document
mm-hmm.
for the service. And the chief of staff to Speaker Kotek came up to me and she said, you know, great job. And she went on to specifics. It was a nice compliment. Compliments that just say great job is one thing. But when they say great job, and here are the three things that I really liked about what you guys did, you know, just you set the model for this, that, or something else. And Errol Blumenauer said something as well, I'll tell you. And she said, there's one problem we have, however. Okay, what's the problem? She said, well, Speaker Kotek really likes this staff for life concept. unpaid staff for life. And I said, so I really put you in kind of a difficult position. She said, yeah. I said, I'm sorry.
Exactly.
Earl Blumenauer came up to me and he said, Denny, by virtue, and he's never been a, you know, obviously a strong supporter or anything like that, but he said, Denny, I, by virtue of the office that I hold, I have to go to a lot of these things, and this was by far the best one I've ever been to. It was just right on, just hit the tone perfectly, and so feel really good about it.
Yeah.
So I'm not negative about that at all. In fact, and some of the backbiting and snippiness was reduced a bit in the second term. Again, because there's less to be gained.
Yeah, exactly.
And people are a little more mature and
that kind of thing. There's a definite end and
All kinds of things. Yeah.
So switch to, well, let's do a minor fun one and then the one that I really want to talk to you about.
The rest of this is just work.
The email that you sent me a couple of days ago said you had a Marty Rosenberg anecdote when you were new press secretary.
I am hot stuff. I've been named press secretary. This is in 79 now. And my picture's been on the front page of the Oregonian. My relationship with my demanding, emotionally abusing father has all of a sudden been settled. In other words, it's not like, you know, it's not like, why aren't you running the family business? You know, was and boy, you made a stupid mistake here. You know, when I didn't get tenure at Oregon State, for example, and then I went to work on this losing campaign, and oh, you really screwed up big time. I mean, he would just chew my ass every mistake I ever made in my life. That was his style. It was loving, but it was his style. So I'm hot stuff, right? I'm now press secretary to the governor. I'm, you know, in the top echelon, and people are saying to my father, is that your kid? Wasn't that the one who used to push freight with you and all this kind of stuff? And and I've actually had a chance to travel with him and come to a conclusion and resolve all that before he died, because he died in March then of 79. And otherwise I'd have been in a rubber room someplace. But I'm hot stuff. My ego is just so inflated, and I've got that big oak desk in that corner office down there at the other end of the thing, and I'm hiring people, and I'm talking to the press, and I know what I'm doing, right? Because I've done this at Oregon State for years, and I'm doing it now. I did it through the campaign. Martin Rosenberg. Denny, what can you tell me about, hold on, who was the state fair director?
Always a problem.
Ron Ingberg. What can you tell me about the resignation of Ron Ingberg, state fair director? And in those days, the state fair director, somebody had, in Straub's time, had made it so that that person, in fact, reported to the governor. Because the state fair was always a pain in the butt. So let's bring it up. We'll get control of this. And I said, quote, who in the hell is Ron Ingberg, and why in the hell should I care about it in the governor's office? And there is a pause, and in the background, I hear. In my entire life and career passed before my eyes, and I said, Martin, yes, Denny, what do I need to do for you that would encourage you to not use that career-ending quote that I inappropriately just gave you? And he said, I need a quote from the governor, I need Ron Ingberg's salary, and I'm on a 40-minute deadline. And 22 minutes later, he had what he wanted, and he has since told me he's now running an energy blog in Kansas City, or someplace in the Midwest, and he had been visiting family out here during the service, and he had made contact with me. And he said, ah, Denny, this is years later, ah, Denny, I never would have burned a source like you. And I said, well, I didn't know that. I said, I was nauseous. But talk about a learning experience.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all of a sudden you realize that you're on the record when you're sleeping. I mean, you wake up at 3 in the morning with a radio station, their tape is rolling, you know, kind of thing. And so, but the woulda, coulda, shouldas kind of thing at that point, man, and I didn't tell anybody that story until years later, and it's rather self-deprecating, but it's kind of self-defecating in many ways, because it could have ended things right there. You serve at the and when I was hired, there were a lot of other people. When you win on something like that in 78, it's a surprise victory in the primary, and it's a reasonable surprise victory in the general, and every big name PR person in the world all of a sudden wants to be the governor's best friend and is being recommended by some corporate giant head that gave a lot of money. And so, you know, it was not, I don't think I was, it was like the day afterwards that he had his meetings with everybody in the campaign. And he said, well, certainly we'll have something for you to be doing, and so on and so forth. I said, well, I'm going to be press secretary. He goes, oh, really? Gosh. There's a lot of people out there who want to be press secretary. I said, I understand that. But I've earned a chance to prove to you that I can do it. And I then had it all ready to go, and I laid out like 4 or 5 points of, you know, I got along with him, number one, and we had good chemistry together. Number two, I knew what his positions were on the issues and would be able to hit the road running, if you will, or the track running. And all these things, I had them all laid out, made the case, and so on and so forth. And he said, well, I don't want to put a string on you. But I said, he said, but let's see how it goes. I'll hire you, but let's see how it goes. And I said, you don't understand, maybe. No, I didn't say it that way. I must have said, you need to understand, and I know you know this, but I'm going to be an executive service appointee, and we all serve at the pleasure of the governor. No notice, no nothing. You walk in, you say, it's not working out, I'm out of a job. Oh, yeah, I know that. Okay. Well, so you got a string on everybody. And that was more of an effort to not make me a special category at the time. I wanted to make sure that everyone from, you know, the people in the executive department, everybody on his staff was at his immediate and often pleasure. And it wasn't just me. So, but, yeah, Martin, I just communicated with him just a couple of weeks ago.
That's great. Okay,
and that's with the Capital Journal, by the way. That was the old Capital Journal. He was a columnist for them.
Cool. Actually, when I left here a week ago and was driving through and not quite getting onto the parkway,
because
traffic was just nuts,
but
I drove by the Capital Press, where my dad worked.
Really? Right there. Interesting.
Yeah, he lived in Medford. Still lives in Medford, but he worked for them for years.
Oh, my God.
He was the cattle guy.
Yeah, they are just a great newspaper for their market and their audience.
I don't
know what their circulation has been doing lately, but they are probably going to be better in print for most people than online, just given their market again.
Yeah, and their online stuff is cranky, really, really cranky.
Okay.
Yeah, my dad started working for them, and at one point he covered Southern Oregon and all of California.
Wow.
He bought a car, and he put 95,000 miles on it the first year.
Because,
you know, it's a long way to Indio to look at the date farmers.
Here's a quote.
Exactly. Okay, so here's the one that I just find really cool. Talk to me about the governor as the micromanager on design and color of campaign materials.
Oh, yeah. Well.
Is this the rug guy? You know,
he's an artist. He's a cartoonist. He's a doodler. He is certainly has that artistic ability. I mean, his granddaughter works for the Oregon Arts Commission, Megan. His daughter is an artist in the sense. She married Bustamante, which is the source of that famous joke of, you know, Chagall, Monet, Bustamante, and when all the arts people went, Bustamante, I need to find out who that is, you know, kind of thing. And so he's got it, and Dolores, she was an art major at the University of Oregon. So yeah, he's always, and if you didn't know that was into the area that you better run a color or a design by him. So he would leave you alone totally on fairly big things. You were held accountable, but you would be left alone for making the decisions. But on that one, you better, and they threw away a bunch of stuff before I came on the campaign because it was the wrong color. I can't remember. I'd have to go look at the file I've got and tell you whether it was the green they threw away and we kept the orange or, you know, I get them all mixed up from one campaign to the next. But, yeah, absolutely, they recycled a whole bunch of stuff.
So is that why the archive has a whole bunch of buttons?
Well, we have a whole bunch of buttons because people want buttons and people want bumper stickers and 0.01% of them wear the button anytime other than a reception for the candidate. And I don't think even that percentage puts a bumper sticker on their car any longer, but they still want them.
Right.
And it's stupid, but you gotta, and you know, lawn signs, almost the same thing. It's not, you know, 1960 anymore. And it's not Bob Packwood running in Northeast Portland anymore. It's a whole different game. But, yeah, the probably a lot of buttons just because of that. The more people who got buttons in our campaign were the collectors. And you'd get standard letters, sent to you that would want, you know, this many, that many, and all this kind of stuff, and so on and so forth. And they would be from all over the country, and, you know, it was just amazing. And I, frankly, we had enough buttons that, you know, and it didn't cost that much to send them out, and what the heck, so we sent them out.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, yeah, I think we've got buttons because we have buttons.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't throw anything away.
But then, so he's looking at all the brochures?
No, no, he's primarily colors.
Oh, okay, colors.
Yeah, primarily
okay.
colors.
Okay.
Yeah, picking the campaign colors.
Okay.
Yeah, and no, he would not look at the design or layout. Now, if the text of something that included issues and stuff like that, our deal was that we didn't do an ad, and that's an ad.
Right.
Unless he approved the text, which evidently some candidates today don't do. But, you know, he didn't have something go out under his name that he had not looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And he may disagree, and we may talk him out of it, saying, no, we've got to say it this way. It's got to be this hard. Mm-hmm. Our polling shows this, that, or something else. Well, all right, but I don't particularly like that. And,
mm-hmm.
you that's why we know we didn't call Ted Kulongoski dangerous,
mm-hmm.
Because we have all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, the colors, it was just really important for him to do that. The whole project of the redesign, not redesign, the cleaning up of the design of the territorial seal,
mm-hmm.
Very important
mm-hmm.
that he was directly involved in that. And I may have and need to get into the box for Pacific. Oh, God, it's all tied up in a big pile. But this is the Oregon State Seal Research Project done by an intern, and all of the variations of the Oregon State Seal over the years. And then the only one of the territorial seal we had was terrible, and he was a proponent. It never I don't believe it happened while we were there, but it happened afterwards, to get away from the Union as a motto and get to the she flies with her own wings, because mm-hmm. it's so much more appropriate for Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And... as you know, his personal stationery has mm-hmm. that state seal or the territorial seal on it, and I've had various Latin scholars tell me that that's not a very good translation or something, and I said, that's not the point.
Yeah.
But,
I lived in, actually, when just as you were being reelected here, that was the day I arrived in Vermont.
Uh-huh.
And so there they have the Universitatis Viridi Montanus, University of the Green Mountains,
uh-huh.
which is really, really bad Latin as well.
Well, I've learned since then that, who is this then? Steve Hersher.
Steve Hersher. Well,
H-E-R-C-H-E-R.
Yes, I've known him since he was 8 years old.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
That is just hilarious. Steve, I'm going to be clipping this out and sending it to you in Prague.
Is that where he is?
Yeah. I actually spent, my wife and I did our 25th anniversary thing in Siena, and he and his wife came and stayed with us for part of it.
But he's got, you know, all of this work on the state seal that he did as part of an internship project.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that was the territorial seal, and that also was the territorial seal.
Uh-huh.
And so we started with that, and then we hired the guy who's the artist who did the original that I found after I... had lost it,
mm-hmm.
and what's in here? Transmitter memos. Close the report that Sue ran off of bond paper. Suggest you look it over. Okay, so it's just multiple copies of the same thing. But, yeah, it was from that and from what they really wanted in the territorial seal when they originally, you know, put it together, and what this research was the basis for starting that process of designing it and cleaning mm-hmm. it up. And it's a great seal. I mean, this seal, as you may know, I mean, I'll get you a copy of this, but a lot of politics, Civil War politics, tied up in that seal.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a much cleaned up version. This is the version that was done in anticipation of the new capital being the new at the time capital mm-hmm. being built,
mm-hmm.
and it was it's a far better rendering, and so we just did the same thing with the territorial seal,
mm-hmm.
and the territorial seal is not protected. I mean, I'd like to almost if you know, depending on what Tom and Suzanne are going to do, I'd love to just take it over from the boss and use it. It has to be pretty big for you to be able to see it. But,
mm-hmm.
Are we done with your question?
Yeah, that was my last question.
Have we turned off our tape recorder?
We haven't. We shall right now.
Okay.